Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. During this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1186, I will have four segments. First, we will listen to the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, highlighting the Israeli genocide in Gaza. During the second segment, I will air the remarks of Greta Thunberg, Swedish activist who was on board the global Sumud flotilla that Israel intercepted in international waters and kidnapped the activist on board, including Greta. During the second segment, I will air a commentary by David Hurst, editor-in-chief of Middle East Eye, criticizing regional leaders for backing the Gaza plan unveiled by U.S. President Donald Trump, because it is not the same plan Arab and Muslim leaders agreed on before the U.S. and apartheid Israel changed it. During the fourth segment, I will air a commentary by Chris Gunness, former chief spokesperson for UNRWA, about October 7, 2023 lies spread by apartheid Israel. The ceasefire announced for the Gaza Strip went into effect on October 10, 2025, while Israel continues its occupation of 58% of the destroyed Gaza Strip, where 2.3 million Palestinians live. The horrific genocide apartheid Israel has committed in Gaza and the destruction of the Gaza Strip over the past 2 years are beyond description. For the past 2 years, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip were living under a brutal, horrific attacks 24/7 by apartheid Israel, massacre after massacre, horrific genocide, atrocities, war crimes, forced starvation, and forced displacements. Let's listen to the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, presented by Noura Burrows-Friedman, associate editor at the Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada newscast. I'm Noura Burrows-Friedman, associate editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 734 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. Early Thursday morning, as news of a possible end to the slaughter began to circulate, journalist Salah al-Jafarawi and his colleagues, along with recording their own updates, informed people by walking in the streets and shouting that there was an end to the war and a hopeful truce. Reporter Anas Ayad captured this clip. Just a few hours ago, Salah al-Jafarawi filmed celebrations in the streets. Members of Gaza's heroic civil defense, he says, share in the joy of the news of a ceasefire. Here is that clip. Palestinians on the ground in Gaza City say that since the ceasefire talks in Egypt began earlier this week, Israel only continued to escalate its attacks. The Gaza government media office stated on Wednesday that in the 4 days since the announcement of a potential truce, Israel carried out 271 separate attacks, killing approximately 126 people, 80 of whom were killed in Gaza City. Our longtime contributor Mohammed Assad uploaded images after the Israeli army destroyed his home earlier this week on October 7th in Gaza City, forcing his family to seek shelter once again. His home was damaged in previous attacks, and his family worked to clean it up and repair it. But this week, it was completely razed to the ground. Quote, "Our dreams turned into a mirage," he said. Earlier in the week, the media office released updated statistics on the 2 years of genocide, including figures on the destruction of homes, livelihood, health, and infrastructure across Gaza. Among the data set was an estimate that Israel has dropped more than 200,000 tons of explosives on Gaza since October 2023. More than 835 mosques were completely destroyed, the media office added, and at least 180 others were damaged, while three churches were damaged in bombings. More than half of all Gaza's 60 cemeteries have been targeted as well, 14 of which have been completely destroyed and 18 partially destroyed. The media office estimates that nearly 80,000 Palestinians have been killed or are still missing since the beginning of the genocide, 67,000 of whom were brought to hospitals and recorded as killed by the health ministry. Nearly 10,000 are missing and still buried under the rubble, and approximately 20,000 children have been killed. Among the dead are 1,015 infants under a year old. 460 Palestinians have died from starvation, and nearly 170,000 have been injured, including 19,000 who will need long-term rehabilitation. 4,800 people have had their limbs amputated, nearly a fifth of them children. Israeli armored vehicles packed with explosives have continued to destroy buildings and entire city blocks around Gaza City, particularly in the Sabra neighborhood. Al Jazeera's Hani Mahmoud reported on Wednesday that, quote, Israeli forces are scaling up attacks aimed at the systematic destruction of the city's remaining infrastructure, flattening what is left of residential buildings, public facilities, and entire neighborhoods. The army is reportedly using remote-controlled explosive robots alongside air attacks and heavy artillery to demolish densely built areas, Mahmoud added. Fighter jets have targeted wide boulevards and high-rise blocks in the city center, leaving large sections of Gaza City reduced to rubble. Despite talk of a potential agreement, many in Gaza believe the Israeli military is rushing to complete the destruction before any truce takes effect. On the ground, people describe what feels like the final stage of destruction, an effort to render Gaza uninhabitable by erasing all means of life, he said. On October 3rd, reporter Hamza Kareka spoke to a grandmother who survived an Israeli attack on tent shelters at the Gaza port. Sitting on the floor next to a metal bed with no mattress where two small children lay unconscious, she asks, quote, "What did children do to deserve this? Three children and their mother, who is my daughter, and my sister, over 15 people were killed in this strike. What did they do?" She says that they were displaced from Jabalia in northern Gaza, and the Israeli army targeted their tent. Palestinian civil defense workers in Gaza say that the situation in the north of Gaza is apocalyptic, especially following last week's closure by Israel of the main north-south road in and out of Gaza City and the rest of the northern governorates. Civil defense ambulance services worker Mohamed Tamous was filmed by journalist Mohamed Abulwai on October 5th. Tamous says that massacres, bombings, and detonations are happening around the clock with no let-up. Quote, entire landmarks and blocks have been erased and have fallen on top of residents' heads. Entire families are erased from the civil registry. In northern Gaza, life has become almost non-existent. There is no electricity, water, food, or drink, or anything suitable for life. The situation here is very difficult, very catastrophic, he said. On October 7th, marking 2 years of Israel's genocide in Gaza, Palestinian civil defense spokesperson Mahmoud Bassal described what 24 months of relentless assault has taken from Palestinians, with the whole world watching. He said that along with the enormous death toll, 2,700 families have been completely erased from the registry, and 6,000 people are now the sole survivors of their entire families. More than 90% of all homes in Gaza, Bassal says, have been destroyed in Israel's two-year assault. More than 80% of Gaza itself is under the control of the Israeli occupation. He says, quote, 2 years of war, and we still say to the whole world, we continue to repeat to the world that we are a people who deserve to live, and that our people deserve to live like any other people in the world, and that they have the right to be safe and at peace without any war or murder. Also on Tuesday, Al Jazeera's Hind Khudari reported that a Palestinian child was shot in the head in eastern Gaza, and six Palestinians were killed in separate attacks in the southern city of Khan Yunis. She said, quote, this shows that despite everything going on in the negotiations over the U.S. proposed ceasefire deal, Palestinians are still being killed throughout the Gaza Strip. The Israeli military's explosive robots continue destroying residential neighborhoods where Palestinians know that even if this war is brought to an end, they won't find anything to go back to. Maha Husseini, a journalist, human rights worker, and researcher in Gaza with the Euromed Human Rights Monitor, recorded this video for the United Nations Human Rights Council meeting earlier this week.
Mr. President, I speak to you from my last refuge after I was forcibly expelled from my home in Gaza City under relentless Israeli bombardment. Though I don't know if by the time you hear these words, I will still be alive or buried under a rubble. Gaza is under unprecedented Israeli attacks, and I have been forcibly displaced with my colleagues at Euromed Human Rights Monitor several times now. I meant to present this statement as a human rights defender, to document and to advocate, but today I can no longer count the Israeli crimes I witnessed because they surround me in every breath and every hour. It's a shame that I had to tear up my business card at some point during this genocide to avoid being killed or detained by the Israeli military. We demand, not plead, we demand immediate protection for those documenting genocide in Gaza. We demand unhindered access for international investigators, and we demand that the perpetrators are brought to justice. Every silence from you, representatives of states and civil society at this council, is another strike of the hammer driving the coffin of the international law.
Maha Husseini of Euromed Human Rights Monitor. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza reported on Tuesday that Israel's destruction of the health system over the last 2 years is complete and deliberate. Quote, over the course of 730 days, the health sector has been subjected to devastating and lethal attacks that have ravaged the very fabric of its services and infrastructure, the health ministry stated. The ministry added, quote, these crimes have earned the description health genocide due to the catastrophic indicators that have ravaged the health and humanitarian landscape in the Gaza Strip. Observers and decision makers in international health and humanitarian institutions are concerned about the success of emergency responses that maintain a minimum level of service. Hospitals have been transformed into concrete structures as a result of direct and indirect military strikes, completely emptied of the components of diagnostic and therapeutic care. More than 1,700 medical personnel have been killed, and 362 are still detained in Israeli torture camps, where they are being deprived of basic human rights. 25 hospitals out of 38 are completely out of service, leaving only 13 still partially operating under difficult conditions. Israel has also destroyed 103 primary healthcare facilities. 55% of all medicines are currently out of stock, two-thirds of all medical supplies are out of stock, and nearly 70% of laboratory supplies are out of stock, the ministry adds. James Elder, the spokesperson for the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, reported from Gaza on the prevention by the Israeli army of newborn incubators earlier this week, deliberately denying the most fragile babies basic machinery to keep them alive.
All missions in Gaza are life-saving, and maybe this one particularly so, heading north right now into Gaza City to a hospital under evacuation order to get incubators out and to other hospitals where they are so desperately in need. Incubators, oxygen, ventilators. Here we go again, fifth time now, fifth time seeking approval to save children's lives. Fifth time.
That was from UNICEF. Last week, we reported on the Global Samud Flotilla, the 44 boats with nearly 500 humanitarian aid activists that attempted to break Israel's siege on Gaza. All of the boats were eventually hijacked and seized by Israeli forces, but the last boat, the Marinette, evaded Israeli capture until Friday, October 3rd. Right before it was hijacked, a Marinette passenger delivered this final message to Palestinians in Gaza.
From the sea to Gaza, we will not forget you. We will not let you to be forgotten. This is the voice of humanity. No one can stop the voice of humanity. Free, free Palestine!
After seizing all of the boats and unlawfully towing them out of international waters into the Ashdod port, Israeli forces detained all of the activists in Ashdod before transferring them to the notorious Ketziot prison in the Nakab Desert. In Ashdod, Israel's extremist national security minister Itamar Ben-Gvir taunted and screamed at the flotilla activists, calling them terrorists. After her release, a Turkish activist described the abusive treatment that they experienced at the hands of Israeli guards. She says, quote, "We protested Ben-Gvir very well. I said, shut your big mouth, you genocidal filth." She goes on to describe the harsh conditions inside the prison and says that there was writing on the wall in dried blood, words written by Palestinian women who had been imprisoned there before. The detained activists were told to drink water from the toilets. 22-year-old Swedish activist Greta Thunberg, who was a participant on the flotilla, was singled out for abuse, according to eyewitnesses. She was physically assaulted, and Israeli soldiers attached an Israeli flag to her back and tied her hands. Italian journalist Lorenzo Agostino described her treatment.
Greta Thunberg, a brave woman who is only 22 years old, she was humiliated and wrapped in an Israeli flag and exhibited like a trophy. I had the feeling of being in a really barbaric place, and I really hope that this barbarism might be over soon. First, we were kidnapped in international waters. Then they took us to land, and once on land, they behaved like a terrorist group. People were kicked. We were left without fresh water for over 2 days. Overall, they took every opportunity to humiliate any of us. We were treated like terrorists because they thought we were terrorists. So I was unlucky enough to get out just while Ben-Gvir was coming. And so the police used very, very tight handcuff on us that stopped our circulation. They blindfolded us and they put us in a van with barely any clothes and with very, very low temperature. So higher conditioning that was like freezing. And they kept her there for probably 3 hours.
After she was released, Greta Thunberg said this at a press conference.
No, wait, no, not heroes. No, no, we are doing the bare minimum. What we are doing is not in any way. No one has to come to the rescue of Palestinian people.
Shifa Abdi, a Finnish Somali activist, told reporters after she was released from Israeli detention that the most shocking thing about the prison wasn't the abuse they faced, but the place itself. She says, quote, "When we arrived at the prison, there was a picture on the wall showing the destruction of Gaza, all the houses in ruins, and Palestinians in Gaza trying to find their families or their belongings. And on that picture, it says in Arabic, Gaza al-Jadida, or New Gaza. They are proud of it. What they have done to Gaza is a source of pride for them. Beneath it was a large, dried blood stain. We had to anxiously think about what had been done to the Palestinians here. Every cell was filled with the names of Palestinian men. We found a piece of cloth we tried to clean with because no one cleaned anything there. And on it, there was an embroidered name, Abu Allah. That's how we found out the names of the Palestinian prisoners. Every night, I was anxiously thinking, where had these men been taken? What had been done to them? Where is Abu Allah? I'm in Helsinki now, but where is Abu Allah? Allah's father, where is he? What have they done to him?" Activist Shifa Abdi speaking in Helsinki earlier this week. Another flotilla of three boats named after the Gaza sunbirds, Ala al-Najjar and Anas al-Sharif, set off towards Gaza from southern Europe as the global Samud flotilla was being hijacked last week. All three boats were intercepted and hijacked by Israeli forces early in the morning on October 8th. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight Underdog Palestine Will Prevail by Asim al-Nabi, writing from Gaza. He writes, quote, "In the brutal arena of history, Palestine has never been a heavy hitter. Israel possesses the warplanes, the tanks, the surveillance networks, and the unwavering backing of global superpowers. The battlefield is tilted, the referee biased, and yet somehow Palestinians are still here, demanding our rights and calling for our freedom, not because we overpower, but because we endure. For colonized people like us, victory was never going to be a knockout punch. We never dreamed of winning in one decisive blow. The imbalance of power is too immense for such fantasies. But if history teaches anything, it's that those who survive each round, bleeding but upright, sustained by clarity and collective purpose, are often the ones who endure until the final bell. What's happening now is more than political. It's epistemic. It's a war of narratives deciding who gets to define reality, whose suffering counts, whose voices are amplified. For decades, Israel dominated the narrative. It set the parameters of discussion and held influence over much of the global media coverage. While that still holds true with the mainstream corporate media in the West today, young Gazans with no electricity and shattered phones are speaking truths that millions are now hearing. Our narrative is breaking through, unfiltered, raw, undeniable. And that is one of the most decisive shifts of all. In the long game of history, narrative matters. Israel is rapidly losing the struggle for moral and political legitimacy. As global perceptions shift and sympathy grows for the Palestinian liberation struggle, the role of memory becomes even more vital. Children raised on truth and dignity do not forget. They carry stories like weapons, like seeds. And when the time comes, they use them to rebuild, to teach, to hold the world accountable. Gaza has long been a synonym for suffering, besieged, bombed, and starved. We have endured nearly two decades of blockade, multiple military aggressions, and for the past 2 years, a genocidal war, the most devastating in our lifetime. Hundreds of thousands displaced, entire neighborhoods wiped off the map, families incinerated in their sleep. And yet, amid all of this, we continue to live, to resist, to speak, to demand our rights, to insist on our freedom. Ultimately, Israel's aim is to break the will of Palestinians and make us believe that resistance is worse than futile, that history has abandoned us, that the world has turned its back on us for good. That is the true purpose of the siege and the bombs and the orchestrated hunger, not just to kill bodies, but to kill the generational chain of the Palestinian narrative of dispossession, return, and liberation. And yet the truth survives, and with it, so do we. Israel's current leadership speaks of total victory and finishing the job. We don't aspire to the brute power of our occupiers. We aspire to be steadfast, and there is no algorithm, satellite, or bomb that can measure the power of a people who have decided not to die. Our victory will not come because we are stronger, but because we are more rooted, because we love this land more than anything else, because we know the face of this land like we know the faces of our children, because we have accepted the high price of freedom, and we pay it in grief, in bread shared between tents, in lullabies sung in the streets. We are not waiting for a final judgment from the World Court or a decisive vote at the UN. These are milestones, not destinations. What we are waiting for is the day when the injustice ends, criminals are held accountable, and the world finally recognizes the Palestinians' right of return and right to exercise self-determination throughout our historic homeland. We don't just fight to survive. We fight to remember, to rebuild, to belong. And we know that justice, though delayed, will not be denied forever. When will that day come? Maybe sooner than we think. After 2 years of unrelenting bloodshed in Gaza, the only dignified response is respect for our sacrifice rather than any attempt to claim credit for our victory. It must also be responded to with sustained, unwavering pressure on governments to halt the killing. The priority now is to end the slaughter and save Gaza and those who remain. Everything else will follow. Those are excerpts from Underdog Palestine Will Prevail by Asim Anabi on electronicintifada.net. Asim is the spokesperson for Gaza Municipality and an engineer and PhD researcher currently based in Gaza City. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Gaza and around the world. Al Jazeera's journalist Noor Abu Rukba filmed herself with a group of kids on October 4th, and she asked why they are happy. "We want an end to the war," they answer. She then asks them where they want to go, and they say they want to go back to their homes and play with their friends.
انتوا ليش مبسوطين؟ ليش مبسوطين؟
مبسوطين؟
عشان الحرب بدها تخلص؟ يا رب تخلص. وين بدكم ترجعوا؟ وين داركم؟ أول ما تخلص الحرب شو بدكم تعملوا؟
نلعب مع صبيانا.
شو كمان؟
نقعد دورنا.
طب يلا يعني نحكي يا رب تخلص الحرب.
يا رب.
يا رب تخلص. يا رب تخلص الحرب.
And our contributor Asima Nabi, from whose story I just read an excerpt, posted this photo of a tree in East Gaza City on October 3rd. He says, quote, "This is the Sidra tree. Legend says it's 1,000 years old, Asim writes. Some believe it's a blessed tree, while others believe it grew over the grave of a saint. Palestinians in Gaza say that people have been unable to uproot it over the past centuries, and that its roots extend dozens of meters underground. This tree sits at the intersection overlooking the Sayyid Hashim Mosque, where the tomb of the Prophet's grandfather, peace and blessings be upon him, is located to the south. If you walk a little east of the tree, you'll reach the Al-Hakimaya neighborhood, where I've lived for half my life. I've never found a neighborhood like it on earth. I passed by the tree today, and memories of a city of roots destroyed by the machine of killing and destruction came flooding back. However, the Gaza tree, impervious to uprooting, spoke volumes that tongues cannot express. This land remains rooted and eternal and will never die." And finally, reporter Saleh Al-Jafarawi captured this clip of the moment he came home and found his cat waiting for him at the door on October 6th. "I missed you," he said to his cat. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. During the Electronic Intifada newscast I just aired, you heard a few comments from Greta Thunberg, the 22-year-old Swedish activist who was on board the global Sumud flotilla that Israel intercepted in international waters and kidnapped the activists on board, including Greta. Well, Greta Thunberg also released the following recorded statement a few days ago.
"And we are now many who are safe and released from imprisonment and absurd mistreatment. But many of our comrades from Global Sumud Flotilla are not, and they need to be released now. But most importantly, we are not the story. Thousands of Palestinians are currently being held in Israeli dungeons without a trial, hundreds of which are children. Millions are living trapped under an illegal siege in an apartheid state and occupation, who are being systematically starved and bombed to pieces. Basic societal infrastructure is being targeted and destroyed, and Palestinians are being systematically deprived of their very, very basic rights and means to survive, such as producing their own food, controlling their own territorial waters, and children being able to go to school. And the whole world knows that this did not start on October the 7th, 2023. And these Israeli war crimes have happened with impunity and with help and legitimizations from our governments, institutions, and media. And this is the story here that people should be focusing on. Do not let me and other volunteers on the flotilla be a distraction. And the Global Sumud Flotilla is about solidarity with Palestinians, international solidarity. And what Israel did was mainly not to illegally abduct us in international waters and abuse us in prison, but it was that it stopped a humanitarian mission and violating international law by preventing humanitarian aid from entering Gaza, a population that are being systematically starved by Israel. And this is a blatant violation of international humanitarian and maritime law. And I also want to make it very clear that our imprisonment by Israel is a direct result of our governments. They keep talking about the importance of upholding human rights and international law and to get aid into Gaza. And then when we do their job, trying to do just that while being completely peaceful and abiding by international law, they failed to ensure our safety. And this mission should not have to exist. It is a last resort when all means fall short and when those in power fail to step up and do the bare minimum. States have a legal obligation to end their complicity in genocide, which the UN Commission now also has confirmed that it is. And this current lack of willingness to do so is a crime against humanity. Israel does not have immunity from international law, even though it might seem like it from their genocidal propaganda. No human being is worth more than any other, and that also applies to Israelis. It's absurd that this even has to be said. And just to have it said once again, of course we are not running errands for Hamas, nor are we terrorists. Israel think they can get away with only recycling their old arguments and smear campaigns to justify their atrocities without addressing the evidence of them committing a genocide. But the world sees through their desperate lies. Terrorism is defined as the calculated act of using violence to incite fear in a population for political control. Is that really what this peaceful humanitarian mission carrying food, medicine, baby formula in line with international law was doing? One can really ask who the real terrorist is here. And I stand by what I have said and stood for since I became an activist at the age of 13. I will continue to fight for a free world, a world free of all forms of oppression and racism, where we put human and planetary well-being over short-term economic profit and geopolitical control for a few. And that might sound naive, but I would any day choose being seen as naive over having double standards and not doing anything in the face of injustice. And I urge everyone to join the global uprising for justice, freedom and equality, and to apply real pressure on our governments and institutions to fulfill their legal obligations to ensure human rights for everyone. We have truth, morale, international law, justice, love, history and solidarity of the world, as well as basic common sense on our side. The war criminals have hate, lies and weapons. Justice will prevail. Free Palestine.
That was Greta Thunberg, Swedish activist who was on board the global Sumud flotilla that Israel intercepted in international waters and kidnapped the activists on board, including Greta. As I mentioned at the top of this episode, an agreement was reached between apartheid Israel and Hamas about ending the Israeli genocide in Gaza. It was a 20-point plan. What you may not know is that the plan was modified after regional Arab and Muslim leaders agreed on the original draft. The U.S. announced that an agreement was reached. Then the U.S. and Israel changed the plan without going back to the Arab and Muslim leaders. And what they presented to the world is the modified plan, saying all parties agreed on. Arab and Muslim leaders were quote-unquote surprised of the modifications that they were not aware of. David Hurst, editor-in-chief of Middle East Eye, recorded this commentary titled "The Great Betrayal: Why Arab and Muslim Rulers Backed Trump's Gaza Plan." Let's take a listen.
When Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu declared peace in our time on Monday, everyone knew it was a charade. What we didn't know then was how much the text of the agreement had changed from when it had been approved by the leaders and foreign ministers of eight Arab and Muslim states in the United Nations, and when it was announced a few days later in Washington. So Turkey and Qatar, who were part of the show, can claim they were duped. But that's a charitable way of reading what they have done. Betrayal is another word that comes to mind. A betrayal performed as a genocide is in full motion and which Netanyahu has been given a green light to continue. The Qataris are furious that they were written out of the mediation role, and Trump refused to delay the announcement. It has since been restored. The Egyptians too are furious that the role of the Palestinian Authority has been downgraded and that Israeli forces will remain in Rafah and along the border with Sinai. But the names of each country are still on the statement welcoming the plan, and neither have withdrawn from it, and both are now arm-twisting Hamas to sign up to it. Either way, each of the eight regional nations that backed this agreement is serving the people of Gaza a bitter and bleak reward for 2 years of enduring the worst military onslaught in the history of this conflict. For Palestinians in Gaza, there is to be no light at the end of the tunnel, only a different form of occupation and a different form of siege. Just at that point in history, when world opinion has turned against Israel, and just as more countries than ever have recognized a Palestinian state, Arab and Muslim leaders have signed up to a plan that ensures a viable state can never emerge from the rubble of Israel's inventions. Turkey can claim it stopped the mass ethnic cleansing of Gaza and brought UN agencies back into Gaza. The United Arab Emirates can claim it stopped Israel's annexation of the West Bank. But both have handed the keys to these issues to Netanyahu. There's no guarantee that they've stopped ethnic cleansing and genocide, because under this agreement, Israeli forces are not leaving the Strip. Netanyahu is the one who decides how quickly and how much of Gaza his forces will hand over to the proposed International Stabilization Force. He's free, too, to decide how much aid and what quality of reconstruction materials he will send in. But there is every guarantee that this post-war plan will stifle at birth a Gaza re-emerging under a Palestinian leadership of any kind. Under this plan, there is no role for any Palestinian leadership in the rebuilding of Gaza. Gaza is split from the occupied West Bank by this agreement, and all thoughts of joining the two have been jettisoned. The PA fares no better than Hamas or the other factions. Already disarmed, the PA has to go much further. Netanyahu demanded at the joint press conference that the PA has to drop its cases against Israel at the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice. It has to stop paying the families of slain fighters. It has to change its school curriculum and tame the media. And only then will Israel see if the PA is ready for statehood. None of the eight leaders, prime ministers or foreign ministers of Turkey, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Jordan, Egypt, Indonesia and Pakistan consulted the Palestinians before agreeing to this plan. Just as the Palestinians have no agency in the authority that's about to be imposed on them in Gaza, they have no say in devising a post-war plan. So where was the Arab counterplan? It didn't exist. Where was the determination to counter Israel's expanding borders? That too is pure make-believe. Differences between the draft they saw in New York and the final statement cover the time limit for handing over the hostages, the distribution of aid, the number of Palestinian prisoners that would be released, the International Stabilization Force, and the lines to which Israeli forces would withdraw. On each of these issues, Israel's control has been hardened and its commitments lessened between the draft agreement agreed at the UN and the announcement in the White House. But the key ones are the commitment on Israel to allow 600 trucks of aid in a day has been replaced by the words full support, without numbers or specifying what equipment Israel will allow in. A commitment to withdraw from all of Gaza has morphed magically into a withdrawal conditional on disarmament and the maintenance of a security perimeter. All these issues were edited out of the statement by Netanyahu, of course, with the full compliance of Steve Witkoff, Trump's envoy, and Jared Kushner, his son-in-law. So where are we now? We have a ceasefire plan substantially worse than the seven others that the US agreed to and that it allowed Netanyahu to tear up. According to this plan, Israeli forces will eventually withdraw to the perimeter, but they will never leave the strip of land between Rafah and Sinai, known as the Philadelphia Corridor. And they will only withdraw to these positions if they're convinced Hamas has handed in all its weapons to the new ISF. No wonder Netanyahu had a big smile on his face. Netanyahu was asked afterwards if he agreed to a Palestinian state. He replied, "Absolutely not. It's not written into the agreement, and there's one thing we did say. We would strongly oppose a Palestinian state." President Trump also said it. He says he understands it. Netanyahu is being truthful for once. The last of the 20 points merely says that the United States will establish a dialogue between Israel and the Palestinians to agree on a political horizon for peaceful and prosperous coexistence. Article 19 only gives the vaguest nod to statehood. It recognizes self-determination as the aspiration of the Palestinian people. Note, not the right. But even that aspiration is contingent on redevelopment advances in Gaza and PA reform faithfully carried out. Who is the arbiter of this process? Why, it's Israel, of course. This did not need the busy hands of Witkoff and Kushner to rewrite. The betrayal of a Palestinian state by those Arab and Muslim leaders who shouted about it for so long was performed long ago. To seal Israel's victory, Tony Blair, the British Prime Minister who invaded Iraq, is back from the dead. No one outside Ramallah has played a bigger role than Blair in keeping Hamas out of a national unity government, which for decades was the only path to deconfliction. In 2006, the year before he became Middle East envoy, Blair sided with the then US President George Bush, rejecting the results of a freely won election, boycotting Hamas, and laying the foundation for a siege that would last for 17 years. The quartet's conditions ensured Hamas's exclusion. And now Blair is back again as a member of the Board of Peace. In 2010, after his term as envoy had expired, the Israeli historian Avi Schleim wrote, "Blair's failure to stand up for Palestinian independence is precisely what endears him to the Israeli establishment." These words read as true about Blair today as they did then. The options for Hamas are bleak. The deal before them is substantially worse than the one that Hezbollah accepted, and even that is being violated on a daily basis by Israel. If Hamas surrenders the hostages, it has no guarantees the war will end, and no more levers to ensure the release of Palestinian prisoners. If they reject it, the war continues with Trump's full backing. No one can be surprised by the speed with which Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Jordan, and Egypt have folded like a pack of cards in their support for an independent Palestinian state. But Turkey and Qatar are in this too. Together, they have betrayed the Palestinians in putting their name to a deal as bad and as one-sided as this. Time and again, they were told to be wary about putting any faith in Trump and his envoys, and time and again, they've been played by him and his religious Zionist backers. Turkish and Qatari ministers knew the dangers of trying to put the clock back to October the 6th, the day before the Hamas attack, when Saudi Arabia was about to normalize with Israel. After 2 years of genocide, we've ended up with a proposed settlement which is substantially worse than the situation that existed on the 6th of October 2023. Israel has a green light to stay in Gaza, either directly or through proxies like Blair. Settlers will continue to invade Al-Aqsa. Bezalel Smotrich, the far-right finance minister and de facto governor of the West Bank, will continue to build settlements. The West Bank is already annexed, indeed, if not in word. This is the same formula tried with the Oslo Accords, but this time it's on steroids. Palestinians can only be allowed to live next to Israel if they put away their flag, cower in the corners of the land settlers have not grabbed, and abandon all plans for an independent state of their own. This is what de-radicalization means. Never have the Palestinians, wherever they live, been more alone. The Arab and Muslim leaders have responded to the bravery and steadfastness that Gaza's Palestinians have shown night and day on their television screens with fear, cowardice, and self-interest.
That was David Hurst, editor-in-chief of Middle East Eye, with a commentary titled "The Great Betrayal: Why Arab and Muslim Rulers Back Trump's Gaza Plan." More about Middle East Eye is at www.middleeasteye.net. Apartheid Israel, as some of you probably know by now, sold to the world, especially the West, its horrific genocide acts against the Palestinians and the destruction of the Gaza Strip based on lies it spread about what happened on October 7, 2023. Those lies have already been challenged and refuted by several outlets, including Israelis. Chris Gunness, former chief spokesperson for the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in the Near East, UNRWA, released this new commentary about October 7th and the lies Israel put out there to Double Down News. Let's listen in.
You see, what happened in October is that the Israelis got their talking points out brilliantly. And as someone who's done public communications, I can recognize. So the narrative went out, it was a surprise attack. There was no real context. There were Hamas butchers. They killed 1,400 people or 1,200. There was no context. Israel could do whatever it liked in order to implement its right of self-defense.
Israel has a right to defend itself.
Israel must have that, does have that right to defend herself.
All of those talking points are wrong. There was a context, the context of 1948, the dispossession of the Palestinians, the context of 1967, the context of the occupation, 2007, the context of the blockade, and then all the conflicts that happened since then. The idea that Israel has the right of self-defense. According to the 2004 legal opinion of the ICJ, occupied people cannot be attacked. The occupying power has an obligation to protect them. And yet here was Israel destroying, blowing them up, doing all these terrible things to them. The idea that it was a butchery by Hamas, people don't report much on the Hannibal directive. And this is a directive that comes, it's an IDF directive that they put to their soldiers. Haaretz, the newspaper in Israel, has reported, has investigated this. There were at least three areas where the Hannibal directive was invoked. Helicopters came in and simply destroyed anyone that was trying to get back into Gaza. That included Israeli soldiers, Israeli hostages, and Hamas and others from Gaza. So there were charred bodies, cars completely blown to smithereens. We don't know how much of that was Hamas and how much of that was the Israeli army. We simply don't know. And yet we accept this narrative that there were these terrorists who came over and butchered 1,400 people. So as I say, the Israeli talking points are either wrong or simply unsubstantiated. And yet that was the narrative which has taken hold.
I saw little kids who are beheaded, We didn't know which head belongs to which kid. We saw a little baby in an oven. These bastards put these babies in an oven and put on the oven.
This idea that it started on October 7th, I first went to Gaza in 2006, and there was a blockade, a collective punishment.
The blockade of the Gaza Strip is creating an atmosphere of deprivation that can only deepen the sense of hopelessness and despair among people.
The whole blockade of Gaza and all the cruelty and economic stifling that we saw, all of that was part of a much bigger design, which ultimately is the determination by Israel that Palestine should not be a state, that Palestinians should not have the right to self-determination.
Our experience is that this radicalizes an already demoralized and isolated population, and the radicalization of Gaza does not serve the interests of peace.
In 2014, I was the UNRWA spokesperson when, during the war, actually, let me not call it a war, it isn't a war. You know, a war is between two opposing armies, and this is a group, 2.3 million people behind a fence who are completely defenceless. And yet we talk about Israel's right to self-defense. We don't talk about the right of self-defense of 2.3 million people who have absolutely nobody to defend them. And that's why actually it isn't a war. It's something else. It's a genocide, actually. So what happened was the Israelis hit a school and Al Jazeera Arabic called me up and wanted an interview. And the Israelis had hit one of our schools. Children had been killed. Their parents had been killed as they slept in the morning in an UNRWA facility. And, you know, they went to that facility thinking that they would have... I really can't talk about it. It really triggers me. Let me try and carry on. Can you edit this bit? It just triggers me. It really does.
The rights of Palestinians, even their children, are wholesale denied, and it's appalling.
I think it really speaks to man's inhumanity to man that in 2014 there were 530 odd children who were killed, and this was absolutely appalling. We have seen a school hit directly. Children sleeping next to their parents on the floor of a UN designated safe area have been killed. It is an affront to the humanity of all of us. The world should hang its head in shame.
Did you tell them about the location of this school and how many people were inside?
17 times we called to give them the precise coordinates of this school and to inform them of the fact that 3,300 people had taken refuge there. So that is certainly not an excuse that can be given.
This is the second time this has happened with a large loss of life. How should the international community respond?
Well, we've made it quite clear that it's time for accountability. We've made it quite clear that those with the power to act should take deliberate political action.
Nothing happened in the way of sanctioning the Israelis. We've now moved to a point where at least 20,000 children have been killed. We don't know how many. And yet, again, there is absolutely no meaningful international reaction. It's an abomination and the world should hang its head in shame. In 2014, in a very short war, over 2,000 Palestinians were killed, and there was frankly not much outrage whatsoever. Quite the reverse. People argued that Israel had the right to self-defense. And yet, on October 7th, half that number were killed, and yet there's sort of massive outrage. Of course, circumstances were different. You had the Israeli army indiscriminately bombing densely populated civilian areas. I would argue that's right up there on the scale of evil, against a proscribed organisation crossing over and, you know, admittedly a fence built round them and doing the things that they did. I don't think that comparing kinds of evil gets us very far, but one can certainly conclude that the international reaction to a Palestinian death is not the same as the international reaction to an Israeli or a Jewish death. And I think that double standard is undeniable. Clearly there is a double standard that 40 beheaded babies that Hamas allegedly did, completely fake news, wrong, made headlines, front pages, people like Piers Morgan bought into it.
I choked up earlier reading this new revelation about 40 babies being killed.
Oh my God.
And some of them being beheaded.
Biden bought into it.
I never really thought that I would see and have confirmed pictures of terrorists beheading children.
All sorts of people bought into it.
Babies and toddlers were found with their heads decapitated.
And yet you've got stories of beheaded babies, fetuses not being even considered as a news story. We also, I mean, there are 150 babies born every day in Gaza and there are no anaesthetics. So women are having birth, giving birth by cesarean section without anaesthetic. I want every mother listening to this to consider what that means. Having your stomach cut open for your child to be born without an anaesthetic. What has to happen in Gaza for the world to wake up to this massive double standard is extraordinary. And what we're now having today is people who've been starved literally to death are crawling to get food. They're being shot at directly by Israeli marksmen, and they're then being taken to hospitals where there are no drugs and anesthetics to treat them. How more inhumane can we get? What's so extraordinary about it is that both the Israeli public and those who support Israel have lost their humanity.
How many civilians have been killed in Gaza, from what you know?
Who gives a...
Okay, but don't you feel like, for example, children?
Children grow up to be Arabs.
I mean, that's the extraordinary thing, that both within Israel, I mean, Israeli media self-censor, so they don't see a lot of it, but there's plenty of social media of Israeli soldiers posting on the internet the appalling things they are doing. But seeing the desensitization, that's the first thing that has to happen if you're going to have a genocide, actually. I mean, a conspiracy theorist might say that this was part of a genocide that's been going on since 1948. And Raphael Lemkin, the man who coined the phrase genocide, was very quick to say that genocide is a continuum. And many Palestinians would say that this continuum began in 1948 with the Nakba. It continues through the gradual dispossession to 1967, where you have the occupation. And if you're in Gaza, all the way through to the blockade of Gaza, which began in 2007. Then you have a series of wars in Gaza because, of course, Hamas and others aren't going to lie there and play dead. They're going to try and resist this blockade, which is an illegal collective punishment. They don't have a conventional army. What can they do? They make rockets. I'm not someone who says that rockets are a good thing. Clearly they kill civilians, and clearly they're a violation of international law because they're so inaccurate. You know, you can't tell where they're going to go. Nonetheless, I think there is a reason for these rockets, and that's 2007 and the imposition of the blockade. And then what's happened is that the wars in Gaza have seen such little reaction from the outside world, the United States principally, but Germany, the European Union, Britain. They haven't sanctioned Israel. They've very belatedly imposed very, very soft and limited sanctions. And so at every stage, Israel has continued with this genocidal project, has looked over its shoulder and seen almost no international reaction. And so incrementally, it's got worse. And that's how we've got to a stage where I can burst into tears on international television and people can be very moved by it. And then here we are all these years later, and children are being slaughtered in a genocidal campaign live on our television sets, and no one seems to care. It's astonishing. But you know, the world will pay a very high price for this lack of humanity. Those governments which were on the wrong side of history will learn, and I think very harshly, that they're on the wrong side of history.
A siege is appropriate? Cutting off power? Cutting off water? Sakir?
Well, I think that Israel does have that right.
I think those politicians who were directly sanctioning genocide will be held to account. And I think that ultimately the state of Israel will face real destitution and ruin. So it doesn't end well for anybody, but least of all for the tens of thousands of civilians who have been butchered in Gaza. If accountability and justice does come, it'll mean absolutely nothing to them. And that's a huge tragedy. Gaza is unique in the annals of contemporary warfare in being the only conflict with a fence around it. Imagine any city anywhere in the world with 2 million people in it crammed into this area behind a fence, and imagine then this kind of destructive conflict taking place every 3 years. There would be absolute outrage and dismay internationally, and that's what we should be seeing over Gaza today. What's really interesting about trauma in Gaza is that after the first conflict in 2008, a child was traumatised. Then in the next one, let's call it 2012, the child is dealing with the real trauma that's going on in its life and the remembered trauma. So there's double trauma. And then in the third trauma, you get the real trauma in the present being dealt with, and the second trauma, and the first trauma. So there's layer upon layer of trauma that these children are dealing with as there's more and more conflict. And that's the terrifying thing, that there are children who are being re-traumatised and re-re-traumatised and re-re-re-re-traumatised. And one talks about intergenerational trauma, that not only are these children who've been traumatised so many times, but they're going to pass their trauma on to the next generation, and that's really terrifying.
All of this, what do you expect me to do? Fix it? I'm only 10. I can't even do anything in this war. I just want to be a doctor or anything to help my people, my cat. I'm just a kid. I don't even know what to do. You see all of the kids around me? They're just kids. Why wouldn't you just send a missile to them and kill them? It's not fair. It's not fair.
I shy away from the analysis that says Palestinians are somehow in their DNA going to be terrorists and people who rise up and butcher their neighbours and whatever. I think that trauma has many different ways of expressing itself. But I think the key point here is that it's an obligation of the world to make sure that trauma is dealt with in a way which is best for each and every individual that's traumatised. I mean, the key thing about Palestinian resistance, I think, is it takes many, many different forms because the Palestinians are so intelligent and so creative. So, of course, just being there, just being on the land, just surviving on the land, saying, I'm here and I will not be moved, you can't genocide me out of history, that in itself is a hugely powerful revolutionary statement. But on the other hand, you've got Palestinians doing the boycott, disinvest and sanctions. There are many different ways that Palestinians resist, but the fact is they have the right to resist occupation and they must never have that right taken away from them. Every Palestinian must be free, and every Palestinian must be free wherever they are. You hear the Likud charter saying, from the river to the sea, you know, there will be no Palestinians. My point is that wherever the Palestinians are, they have a full range of rights as defined in the 30 articles of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the foundational document that gives us all of our rights. And those rights include the right to self-determination. The Palestinians must, and I believe will have one day, all of those rights. I think that predictions of the demise of the Palestinian people are premature. And I think that because time and time again, through so many of the conflicts, the Palestinians simply pick themselves up. Their dignity is somehow restored through their amazing humanity, and they carry on. And the tragic and the very sad thing in a way about all this is that I have no doubt that the children in Gaza who you see playing in the refugee camps, the children who you see striving to get an education, those sorts of vignettes of life in Gaza are the seeds of hope. And although it's very easy to cede to the counsel of despair, I refuse to do that. And I think that it's wrong, really, to talk about the final solution to the Palestinians. I think there are many Israelis and Americans in their sort of Hitlerian mindsets would love to see this as the final solution of the Palestinians. But the Palestinians are much bigger than that, and they have too long a history of national revolution and national pride. And I think we're going to see that rising from the ashes of Gaza. Double Down News brands itself as the future of journalism. And I have to say, the more I consume media stuff, the more I think they really are the future of journalism. They dare to say things which other people don't. They dare to challenge the narrative, the orthodoxy that's pervaded by many of mainstream media. And I think for that reason alone, amongst many others, I think they're really worthy of your support. So join the future of journalism. Support Double Down News on Patreon.
That was Chris Gunness, former chief spokesperson for UNRWA, with a commentary to Double Down News on the lies of October 7th. More about Double Down News is at www.doubledown.news. You've been listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.